Okay, so as we start out today, Paul, can you get my, there we go. I have a question for you. Where does God fit into your life? Now, I'll admit, this is a flawed question. It's probably not the question we should most be asking, but it's a question I'll start with. And maybe for some of you, as you think about where does God fit in your life, that question makes you a little bit anxious because you know that God belongs somewhere there. He belongs in your life somewhere, but you're not sure maybe where he is right now. And as you think about your life, you feel like it's one of those closets, you know, like we're at the closets where you're afraid to open the door because once you open it, you don't know what's going to happen. I got some closets in my house like that. So maybe you feel like your life is like this, it's jam-packed and full of stuff. And you're trying to find God in there, you're trying to put God in there, and you just can't find any spare inch to put him. Or maybe, as you think about your life, it's like one of these neatly organized closets. I don't have any of those in my house. But where everything is laid out in a nice little plastic container, and everything has its shelf and its place, and it's labeled. And they're clear, so you can see inside of them anyway if it's not labeled. And it's beautiful. But you, as you think about God, sometimes you're not sure, okay, should I have God more in my life? Or is he only in that one spot? Does he only get the Sunday morning? Does he only get these spare moments in my mornings, maybe for a quiet time? Or these like kind of odds and ends? Or does God deserve a more prominent place? So this question of where does God fit into our lives can bring a lot of anxieties. And that's not my primary purpose today. Our lives are anxious enough as they are. But I think it's important to wonder where we do fit into God's plan and where our lives fit with him. And so as we think about crossing boundaries, and last week we talked a lot about the mission of God, which is the mission of the church. And God's mission is to reconcile all people to himself and to restore everything to the way it should have been. And that mission has been passed on to the church. But in order for us to fulfill that mission, we're going to have to follow in the footsteps of Jesus, and we're going to have to be willing to cross boundaries into other people's lives. And one of the first boundaries we might find are these personal boundaries that we draw in our lives. Now, boundaries aren't a bad thing, necessarily. We need boundaries. Boundaries can help preserve us and protect us. But sometimes we've drawn these boundaries around where God can fit in our lives, and that really excludes certain opportunities that he might send our way. And so as we think about crossing these personal boundaries that we've set, I want us to look at Mark chapter 5, starting with verse 21. Jesus crossed a lot of boundaries when he was here on earth. You could just say the first one was theological in nature. God, the eternal second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, took on human flesh and walked among us. That's a huge boundary to cross. And he didn't stop crossing boundaries when he walked onto the earth either. There were many other things that he did. And today we're going to look at how he responded to certain moments and opportunities that came his way. So we start with Mark chapter 5, verse 21. We're told that when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. So Jesus had been over kind of in Gentile territory before this. And I'm not sure what his agenda is in crossing the lake and what he had planned. We're never told that. I have to assume that he kind of expected the crowds to come because they always came. People heard that Jesus was in a given place and they're like, we got to hear him. They wanted to hear his teaching, but they also wanted to see him do his thing, like, because he healed people and he set people free from demons. And this was all great spectacle, but it filled them with a lot of hope. And so they wanted to be a part of that and to see what was happening. So then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, my little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. So Jesus went with him. So this is the first kind of interruption, I guess, to Jesus' potential plan. And he probably knew that people were going to come to be healed because they often did. But here we have this guy named Jairus. Now, Jairus is not just anyone. He's a synagogue leader. So synagogues for the Jewish people were kind of like their churches. So in Jewish religion, there's one temple. That was by design. There's only one place you could worship where you could offer sacrifices, and it was there in Jerusalem. And so these synagogues weren't places you could offer sacrifices, but they were places you could go to worship. And so Jairus is one of the leaders in that synagogue. So he's a person of standing. And he comes before Jesus with a somewhat bold request. Jesus, can you come with me? My daughter is dying. Now, it would seem unconscionable for Jesus not to go with Jairus. But I could think of reasons why in that moment Jesus might say, okay, let me do this thing I have. Let me teach these people first. He's got a crowd in front of him. So he's going to have to leave this crowd and go and fulfill this man's request. And you also remember that if you're Jesus, somewhere in the back of your mind, maybe you're thinking, look, if I go with every person who ever asked me to heal somebody, I'm never going to do anything besides do that. Because someone's always going to have someone sick that they want to be healed. But Jesus doesn't care. He just stops what he's doing. He stops teaching this mass of people, stops interacting with them, and goes with Jairus. Doesn't even seem like with any additional thought. He just goes. Okay, so this is how he responds to that opportunity. So a large crowd followed and pressed around him. So obviously people want to see what's going to go down. They're really interested. They're excited what's going to happen. So they go with Jesus. And a woman who was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors. That's not really a ringing endorsement of healthcare, right? She has suffered under the care of many doctors and has spent all she had. Yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. So this woman is in a very desperate position. So in Luke, we're told that her issue was that she had some sort of internal bleeding issue. Now, these are notoriously tricky to deal with. I know this because my mom had an internal bleeding issue a couple of years ago, and doctors were never able to figure out where it came from and why it happened. She was better, but she had she got to have transfusions, which I'm sure this woman didn't have. So she's in a tough position. She's been in that position for 12 years, we're told. So beyond the whatever physical discomfort this caused her and how this might have threatened her life, this also put her in a very awkward position in Jewish culture. Because according to Jewish law, there were certain things that made you unclean, and bleeding was one of them. Like having this kind of internal bleeding issue would have made her unclean. And that meant that everything she touched would have been unclean as well. So because of this, like people who had that kind of condition or leprosy or some other skin condition that was considered unclean, not only could they not go to the temple to worship, but they often couldn't go really, I mean, they were probably excluded by polite society. I'm also struck by the fact there's no one here to advocate for her. Jairus, his daughter, has her father there to advocate for her. Like, you know, the paralytic in Mark chapter 2 had these four friends. This woman seemingly has nobody who's looking out for her. And I would assume because of that, and again, I'm making some assumptions here that I could be wrong about, she's probably older. Maybe she's a widow. Maybe she never got married. Who knows? Does she have kids? I don't know, but they're not here advocating for her. So she's in a position where she feels like she has to do this on her own. So she's not in a very good position. And that probably explains her kind of thinking here. Because when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. Because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. And of course, that's what's happened. So if you can, you know, kind of picture this, this is kind of tough to do, but she's there in the crowd, and there's a lot of people there, and somehow she's going to sneak and just touch his robe, so she's got to get close enough. I'm not trying to say cowardly way, but this is a way of dealing without getting attention to yourself. On the other hand, though, it's somewhat bold, because technically speaking, she's making Jesus unclean by touching him, okay? But she thinks, this is her thinking, that if I just touch his robe, that's enough. I don't need any more attention. I don't need him to talk to me. I don't need him to look at me. He's powerful enough to heal me. Now, there might be some desperation mixed in here, where, like, what else does she have? But she doesn't want to call attention to herself, and she does this on the down low, and Jesus heals her. So we might wonder, okay, is this, like, magic clothes Jesus has? Is this how it works? You know, you just touch him, everybody's better. The interesting thing is what happens is Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, so he senses it. And he turned around the crowd and asked, who touched my clothes? Now, it's somewhat of an interesting theological issue the Son of God is asking this kind of question, because we think, well, okay, Son of God, you're the Son of God, which means you should know everything. Don't you know who touched you? Now, some people have argued about how exactly the incarnation works, how the divine nature interacts with the human nature. Were there limitations to Jesus' knowledge? That's a thorny road to go down today, so I'm going to skillfully just avoid it. I guess not so skillfully, because I just told you that. But one way that people have sort of skirted this issue is by saying he wants to have a conversation about this. And that's why he asked this question. He's trying to make this interaction happen. So he says, who touched my clothes? And the disciples, I think, somewhat exasperated, are like, you see the people crowding against you, and yet you can ask, who touched me? There's a big crowd around Jesus. This is akin to being in like Times Square and you're like around Christmas time and you're like, you're walking down the street and then someone bumps into you and you stop and you're like, who just bumped me? Like, would you ever do that in 1,000 years? No, of course not. Bad things might happen. But like probably 20 people just touched you. Like, you're going to get touched in Times Square. Hopefully not inappropriately, but something's going to happen there, right? So this is what happened. And the disciples are like, you have people all around you. Of course someone bumped into you or touched you, okay? You're in a crowd. But Jesus keeps making a sort of a scene about it. Kept looking around to see who had done it. Then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear. Look at that reaction. She's trembling with fear, falling to her feet. Why does she respond that way for? Because once she explains what she's done, she's afraid. She's afraid that Jesus is going to be angry at her. Afraid that she's made him unclean. She's basically going to have to admit to that. The whole thing here was she wanted to hide this. She wanted to cover it up. She wanted to disappear into the crowd. And now she's being brought out in front of for everyone to see. And she told Jesus the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. I wonder when the last time someone called her daughter was. I really do. You know, like we hit a certain point in, like, if our parents aren't around anymore, like, nobody calls us son or daughter. Nobody thinks about that aspect of our lives, that we were once this, like, dearly loved and cherished child, you know, growing up. But that's how Jesus looks at her. Daughter, your faith has healed you. He saw her differently. And I think Jesus forces this encounter so she knows that she was not healed by accident. She was not healed by manipulation. She was healed because she is a loved and cherished daughter of God. This moment kind of reminds me of this work camp trip we took with the kids. When I say work camp, it's not like a Soviet work camp. It's more like a mission trip that we went on. So we went to a community upstate New York with a lot of other churches, and we just did basic service work. Like, it wasn't really like, it wasn't even like, you know, like feeding or, you know, taking care of people who are the poorest or whatever, but we were just working in different places. Like, so my group worked in a assisted living home. And in my group, we had this other adult named Chris. Now, Chris was a gifted musician. And he led worship for our group while he was there. And so somebody came up with the idea, because we had played bingo like 100 times with these people, and like you can only handle so much bingo. Well, the seniors can handle lots of bingo, but we could only handle so much bingo. So we got to do something different, something more meaningful than bingo. So let's go. Somebody came up with the idea of going caroling. Now, it was summer, so it wasn't like Christmas songs we were singing. But we went to room by room, and we sang worship songs to people. Now, we didn't force it upon you, so if you didn't want it, we weren't going to barge in your room and make you listen. But we went around and just, like, sang these, like, three or four songs, like Amazing Grace, you know, songs that seniors love, right? We always finish our nursing home service with Amazing Grace. And I feel like if we didn't, there would be some sort of riot. We didn't sing the fourth verse once, and people were mad. They were mad. So we sang songs that had meaning to people, or some hymns as best we could. And we went to this one room, and there was this older lady, because they're all older in nursing home. So I'm just watching her, and she's sitting on the edge of her bed. And, like, she has this far-off look on her face. Like, you know she's not in that room anymore. She's somewhere else. Like, she's remembering something. I think we were singing Amazing Grace. And I just had this, like, this quick vision in my head that, like, when God looked at her, he was looking at his daughter. And not that I don't like old people, because I do, and or that I look down on them for whatever reason, but like I in that moment I saw her differently. It was kind of this quick, fleeting thing that passed. But I just had this impressed on my soul, that's how God saw her. And I feel like the same thing happens to this woman with the bleeding issue. She's been looked down upon for years by the rest of her society. And Jesus forces this encounter so that she remembers how loved she is. Now, imagine that you're Jairus in this moment, and you're watching Jesus, like, sort of make this scene, and you're like, come on, Jesus. My daughter's dying. We have to go. This is urgent. We don't have any time to spare. If you're Jairus, maybe you're getting a little frustrated because you know what's at stake. And this is your last hope. There's no other hope besides the fact that this rabbi, this Jesus, can heal your daughter. You have nothing else to hope in. And so you're probably just there trying to be polite, but you got to be tapping your foot like wondering, come on, why are we still here? And then what happens? While Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" How did Jairus react to that? I mean, people handle grief in so many different ways. Like, if he just dropped down to his knees and started sobbing, I'd understand. If he was just completely in shock and overwhelmed and couldn't say anything, I'd understand that too. So Jesus is still speaking with this woman, I think. And, you know, he overhears what happens. But so again, Jairus is just going to be crushed in this moment. This last hope has been dashed. And so these representatives are like, just don't bother. Don't trouble the teacher anymore. I'm sure he's very busy. Let him go do something else. And then Jesus responds, "Do not fear, just believe." So don't be afraid, just believe. Doesn't tell him what he's going to do, just says, don't be afraid. It's hard to tell in the sequence of the gospel sometimes what events happen when. So I don't know at this point if Jesus actually raised somebody from the dead. He only raises three people from the dead in all the gospels. So there's a widow's son, there's Jairus' daughter, there's Lazarus, of course. I guess four if you count Jesus himself, but those are the only resurrections that we see. So at this point, I don't know that Jairus has any real reason to hope that Jesus can do anything for his daughter. But Jairus goes with him. They keep walking. All right, so at this point, Jesus does not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. So the crowd beat it. Other nine disciples, nope, can't go any further. When they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. That is a super weird reaction to have in that moment. Now look, if I was a person and I was having a funeral for a loved one, and I had someone come in and tell me, "Oh, he's not dead, he's asleep," I would not be happy about them, but I wouldn't laugh. I'd be angry. I'd probably throw them out or like have someone else remove them or remove them myself. I don't know, but I wouldn't be happy because this person's saying something like, you know, this is potentially hurt. This is very hurtful, right? These people laugh. What do they laugh for? Well, one potential explanation is that in Jewish culture, there were these professional mourners. So this was just part of the culture that when someone died, you made a big deal out of it, and you could actually hire people who would mourn your loss. Now, this doesn't suit my taste at all. Don't do it for me. I don't want that. Not that I'm planning to die, but it's going to happen sometime. But, you know, if you're there, make sure this doesn't happen. I don't want people making a big deal of it. But the intent was, like, to show how valued and loved this individual was, right? And so, you know, Jesus tells them, you know, she's not dead, but she's asleep, and they just kind of laugh at him. Jesus pretty much ignores them, goes into the house, and he put them all out, so he threw them out. That's how I read that. He took the child's father and mother and disciples who were with him and went in where the child was. He took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." So that's Aramaic. This is a term of endearment. It might be more on line with, like, honey or sweetie or darling, something like that. So Jesus says, just get up. Immediately, the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old. Kind of weird how I just kind of throw that in at the moment. But what else was 12 in this passage? The woman bled for 12 years, right? So there's a little bit of a parallelism going on there. At this, they were completely astonished. Yeah, I think that's like the lightest word you could use to describe what they were feeling. Imagine the reversal in emotion. You're devastated as her parents. You know, your hope for this little child, you know, who had her whole life stretched out before, has been dashed to pieces, and all of a sudden, it's restored, and she comes back to life. Like, I don't know there's a word to capture that feeling. It doesn't exist in English, as far as I know. Overjoyed, that's way weak than probably what they're feeling. So, he gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and told them to give her something to eat. Okay, she's probably hungry. That makes sense. But the part about not telling anyone is kind of weird, too. Because, okay, think about this. Who knows about this girl dying now? At least those mourners outside. Jairus' parents, for sure. The crowd where Jesus was, where he's told that she's dead. I'm sure people overheard that. Lots of people know that she died. And then Jesus went into her house, and she's not dead anymore. So do the math on that one, right? Like, what happened? So I don't know that this story kind of was kept under wraps for this reason, but why does Jesus tell them that? Now, it's possible, because look, this happened a lot, and it still happens, actually. I read about a case not like maybe a decade ago, I think it was in Brazil, where someone was pronounced dead, and they weren't really dead. They were taken down to the morgue, and they had a very rude awakening when they woke up, okay, because they were in a refrigerator, and like, you know, like they, people had, and then somebody was, whoever was in the morgue was really freaked out because this person wasn't really dead. So this stuff actually still happens. They're not dead, they're mostly dead, right? So, to quote The Princess Bride. So this does happen, so maybe that's how they explain this away, that, oh, she wasn't really completely dead, but we just kind of thought she was. Maybe that's what happened, I don't know. Maybe that's what Jesus is counting on. But why does he try to keep such a keep this under wraps for? Why doesn't he want people to know? Because you see him do this at other times. Jesus heals a leper. Don't tell anyone what I did for you. So he does a lot of this stuff. Now, why does he do it? He's terrible at PR. Okay, that's one part. But Jesus, again, his point in coming here as the Son of God, being incarnated, is not to heal people. I mean, he loves doing this, I think. He loves showing the love of God and compassion to people. But his sights are set much higher. He's not there to heal some people, because that little girl, I don't want to spoil this for you, but she died again. So did Lazarus. So did the widow's son. Jesus didn't come for this temporary life. He came to bring eternal life. And so he wants to go around. And he wants to actually minister to people and teach them about God and reveal God to them. That's his primary reason for being there. Now, the miracles do that, but he doesn't want his life to be completely about miracles. Because there are some points when people just, like, they kind of press around him, and he almost can't do anything. And there's another point in John chapter 6 where after he fed the 5,000, they want to make him king. They're so overwhelmed by the fact they were fed by these 5 loaves of bread and 2 fishes. They're like, man, this guy is legit. Let's make him our king right now. And that was not his priority. That was not his mission. So that kind of explains why he does these things. But as we go through this story, I want you to see how Jesus responds to these moment-by-moment opportunities to help people. He almost always just drops everything to be with them. And you can see this throughout the gospel. There's another moment, actually, what precipitates the feeding of the 5,000. It's a very heavy moment in Jesus' life. So he's sent his disciples out on their own for the first time. They've gone around telling other people about the gospel. And they've been doing what Jesus has been doing, and they've just returned to Jesus, and Jesus wants to debrief them, spend some time with them together alone. At the same time, John the Baptist, who you can kind of look at as Jesus' mentor, he's also family, he's related to Jesus, but John the Baptist was just executed. Now, that probably made Jesus sad just in itself, but he also sees this is a precursor to what's going to happen to him. When John the Baptist is executed, Jesus knows the same thing will happen to me. Not in the same way, but I'm going to be executed as well. So it has to be a heavy moment. And when Jesus is with his disciples, he wants to be alone with them, crowds find him. And they kind of press in. And I think the disciples just want Jesus to send them away because they're exhausted. They don't want to deal with it. But Jesus won't do it because he looks at them and he sees them differently. He sees them as sheep without a shepherd. And they need someone to lead them and they need someone to teach them. And he can't send them away, even though he had a very different agenda in that moment. So Jesus always, it seems like he almost always responds to these little moments and like, okay, I'm gonna meet whatever needs are before me. And I'm gonna allow my life to be interrupted, my agenda, such as it was, to be interrupted as well. Now there are moments where Jesus preserves boundaries as well, because maybe you're thinking, well, I can't always say yes to things. Won't I get burnt out and exhausted? Okay, I think that's probably true. But you see moments where Jesus, like one of his busiest days in Capernaum, early on in his ministry, he's just ministering all day, teaching in the synagogue, healing in Peter's house. Like people are just coming to him, you know, late into the night to be healed. Like how many sick people are in this little fishing village anyway? Apparently a lot. And they kept coming to him and he kept healing them. And the next morning, instead of sleeping in, he goes out into the wilderness and he prays. In fact, nobody can find him, and they're like looking around for him because they want more teaching, they want more healing. Where'd Jesus go? And they eventually find him and like, you know, oh, I'm praying. And then, you know, that recharges him, that reminds him what his purpose is. And so it kind of resets his day. So you do see Jesus setting some boundaries, you know, where he could have just been sucked into being in that one town again, but he knows, I have to go other places. This is the mission. I can't just stay in one town. I got to go from place to place. Everyone needs to hear this. But again, see how his agenda is still very people-driven? It's very people-centric. So Jesus heals this girl. He takes it, you know, and course we know that's coming, but he stops what he's doing to heal the girl. He stops what he's doing to go heal the girl to heal this other woman. And you see Jesus throughout the Gospels preserving this kind of like ethic. Like he's always going to meet the needs of what needs are before him. All right, so you know I love to tell college stories. So back when I was in college, there was a time in my life where I felt for a while like everywhere I went, it seemed like there were these little divine appointments. You know what I mean? Like I'd go someplace and there'd be this one person I kind of tangentially knew and we'd start talking. I know, Steve talking to people seems weird, but I did this kind of thing. And, you know, I would talk to people and like the conversation would turn like spiritual and we'd end up talking about Jesus and about faith and I ended up sharing my faith. And I think there's a lot of self-aggrandizement going on in that moment because I thought it happened all the time and it probably was only like a handful of times. But there was one night I got out of class and I was just tired. Like, I'm an introvert by nature, so I can't always be having these conversations. Even 3 to 4 conversations, that's a lot for me to handle. So this one night going back to class, I was like, you know what? I'm going to take the back way home. You know, because God will never see this coming. Yeah, I know, it's stupid. But that's what I was thinking. You know, like, I'll just go the back way. There'll be no conversations, nothing, and, like, I'll get home. I actually did get home. So to this day, I don't think I tricked God. It's just there was nothing on that one day. But why did I do that for? Because, like, you know, like, there are these moments I just didn't want to give up of myself. And again, setting boundaries is not a bad thing in and of itself. But sometimes we draw these boundaries and are like, people can't come here. Like, if you want help from me, you can only approach me during these times. It's a very narrow window. I'm trying to think, like, not as narrow as, definitely narrower than Cablevision's window of when they're coming to help at your house, because that's pretty big. But ours is usually smaller than that. And if we're honest, if we have a spectrum of sort of passing up opportunities because we think that this is our lives and we don't want to do the thing that we think that maybe God's putting in front of us in a moment, if that's one end of the spectrum, and the other one is saying yes to every opportunity that comes our way to the point that we're exhausted and burning out, like, which end of the spectrum do you feel like we're more on? Now, I'm not going to answer that for you. I can just answer personally, I'm probably more towards the passing up opportunity spectrum side than I am on the other one. Because there's just so many moments I'm like, this is mine. I can't give this up right now. And so in order to meet the needs of other people, to live the mission of God, we have to be willing to cross sometimes these personal boundaries that we've drawn for ourselves. And again, like maybe as you're thinking about that, that makes you anxious because you're like, my life is so packed with things. What more do you want me to do? And maybe you want to yell at me. I don't know. Because sometimes, you know, as pastors, we can definitely lay that guilt trip on you. You know, we don't want to make it about guilt. But, you know, I told you in the beginning that the question I asked you was flawed. I asked you, where does God fit into your life? This is the better question. Where does your life fit into the mission of God? Sometimes we're always trying to see, okay, God, what do you have for me today? What do you have to communicate to me? Where really we should be asking, God, where do I fit in your plan? Your plan's unfolding in my life. How does my life fit? What do I need to do to reorient myself to what you want me to do? That's a better question, I think. Because what it allows you to do is to re-see your life. In fact, you know, this is what I think we need to take away from this. Sometimes we need to rethink our life. And so that we don't think about our life as a sovereign nation unto itself, but as part of the larger unfolding plan of God. If we can see our lives like that, then like our job is not just about meeting physical needs for ourselves, but it's about, okay, how can I serve God where I work, with these people that I work with these people I rub shoulders with every day? How can I serve God within my home, within my family? With these, whether you have children or not, or you're married or not, how can I like serve God with my family? How can I serve God with the friends that I have? So it's not about putting more into your life and shoving more into that closet. It's about reorganizing and seeing how things work together. Sometimes we do need to simplify. Sometimes we have way too much going on that doesn't need to be there. I mean, let's be honest. Do we need to be doing all the things that we're doing? Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is no. Sometimes there are things that you have, burdens you have taken upon yourself that you do not need to carry. You know, and our children's lives are way more complicated than they used to be. Like growing up, you know, I feel like, and not that I grew up in some bygone era, you know, it was like the 90s. But, you know, I was like on one sports team, you know, for a season. And like, you know, I wasn't doing a lot. Now, also, Steve, very introverted, not always pressing to do a lot. But I was always doing something, but I wasn't doing so much that my parents were like overworked by that. So that's just an idea. Like, sometimes we get our kids into too much and we're pushing them into too many things, and they need to simplify too. So we can simplify our lives. You can actually do this. You can probably find things in your life that you don't need to do. And they're not just fun things, but like, you know, maybe things that you feel really burdened by. I don't know. I don't know your life. That's something that you have, that's some thought that you have to put into your life, not me. I think we need to re-see people, because really what enables Jesus to see these people as opportunities and not distractions or not interruptions is that these are people, he sees their needs. This story about Jairus and the woman who's been bleeding for 12 years is about daughters, two daughters, not just one. It's easy to see Jairus' daughter in this because she's the one who's got her life in front of her. She's the one who's got everything, you know, everything ahead for her, right? This woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, maybe she's older, whatever, people don't see her as easily. You know, we see certain people, we see their needs sometimes more importantly than we see other people's needs. And when we can start to re-see people the way Jesus sees them, it enables us to actually to greet them, not as interruptions to our lives, but as ways that maybe we can serve God in that moment. And it's not, you know, you can use talk about them, but you can also look at the, Jesus looking at that crowd and seeing not people who are going to steal his time, but people who are lost, people who are sheep without a shepherd. Can we see people like that? Well, unless we kind of humble ourselves and realize how God sees us and what God has done for us, that God has offered himself for us, people who very well could have been nuisances to him, unless we realize how much God has given to us, despite the fact that a lot of times we don't deserve it, we'll never show the same grace to other people. And so if you want to cross boundaries, and personal boundaries that you have drawn for yourself, maybe this is what you need to do. You need to re-see your life. You need to rethink your life. You need to simplify. And you have to be willing to see these people differently, the way God sees them, because he does see them differently. And you want to get a glimpse, keep reading the Gospels. Keep seeing how Jesus responds to people who everyone else looks down upon, and he doesn't. And that maybe will help you see them the same way. So unless you're willing to cross these personal boundaries, all the other boundaries we're going to talk about, crossing, you know, cultural boundaries, ideological boundaries, political boundaries, none of those actually matter if you're not willing to cross the boundaries that you've made for yourself. Let's pray. God, I pray that you'd help us to be wise to the ways that we have divided our lives, the ways that we have drawn our time, the way that we think that we should be spending our lives. Help us to see that in a different light this morning. Help us to see everything in a different way, that we could see people in a different way, that we could see them according to their needs, according to your love, according to the fact that you made them and composed them in your image, that we could see them that way. And that as we see people differently, we'd see our lives differently, and that we would rise up and meet the opportunities that you bring us. So we ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.